John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
After 20 years of failed negotiations with Israel, the Palestinian Authority plans to go before the United Nations in September to win statehood. The move to gain recognition for a Palestinian state is opposed by the United States and Israel and comes with significant political risks, notes the Christian Science Monitor. Palestinians cannot win actual legal recognition without an endorsement from the United Nations Security Council. The Obama administration has promised to veto any statehood proposal put forth by the Palestinian Authority, and the U.S. Congress could cut aid to the authority if it moves for full independence. Moreover, Israel has threatened unilateral action in case the Palestinians win independence. In addition, some Palestinian negotiators say a symbolic resolution by the UN General Assembly will not help end Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. In late June, an opinion poll found two-thirds of Palestinians support the UN bid for statehood. There is a strong expectation the Palestinian Authority will follow through after a UN vote to enforce Palestinian rule in the West Bank. A former Palestinian negotiator who is skeptical of the UN effort noted, despite protestations at the UN, Israel occupied Lebanon for two decades and is still occupying the Golan Heights in Syria.
Welcome to Palestine Today, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, July 20th, 2011. Palestinians slam a video by Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs describing it as distortion of international law. Meanwhile, Israeli airstrikes hit the Gaza Strip. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli Air Force gunships launched airstrikes on two sites in the northern Gaza Strip on Wednesday morning. The airstrike targeted Az-Zaytun and Ash-Shuja'iyya neighborhoods south of Gaza City, causing massive structural damage. However, no casualties among civilians were reported. Israeli military said the airstrikes come in response to Palestinian firing homemade shells against Israeli targets in the southern part of Israel. Two homemade shells landed near Sderot in the Negev Tuesday night, causing no damage nor injuries. In the West Bank, Israeli forces invaded the village of Taluza near Nablus on Wednesday morning and kidnapped two Palestinians. The WAFA news agency reported that 30 military vehicles invaded the village and troops broke into houses and ransacked them before they kidnapped Hossam Abu Shakra, 52, and his son Hazem, 28. They were blindfolded, handcuffed, and were taken to unknown destination. Local residents accused the soldiers of stealing gold and other valuables during the attack on their houses. Rabah Salahat, a resident of the village, said soldiers stole gold belonging to his wife after raiding his home at 2 a.m. and forced his family outside. He said the stolen gold is worth around $4,500. Israeli troops have also kidnapped Mohammed Zayed, 22, from Al Yamun village near Jenin and invaded a number of Palestinian villages and towns since Wednesday dawn. In the meantime, Palestinian chief negotiator Saeb Barakat said in a press release published Wednesday that a recently released YouTube video by Israel's foreign ministry shows that Israel is not interested in the peace process. The video features Israeli Foreign Minister Deputy Danny Ayalon explaining the evolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as animated illustrations appear behind him. In the video, Ayalon denies the existence of Palestine and the Palestinians and demands that the West Bank be called a disputed area instead of occupied territories. Ayalon also said that all settlements Israel built in the West Bank are legal. That rounds up the main news for today. Please join us again tomorrow for a summary of important events in the Palestinian territories. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imenc.org. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, George Rushmau.
Here is a report from the Tuesday edition of Palestine Today on the Israeli attack on the Freedom Flotilla ship Dignity and the status of other Freedom Flotilla ships.
The Spanish ship, the Guernica, part of the second Freedom Flotilla that has remained at Port Kolymyavi for 2 weeks, has finally been authorized by Greek authorities to set sail back to Spain, but is not authorized to set sail to Gaza. Public endorsements from Norway and Syria are the most recent gains in the Palestinian pursuit of statehood recognition through the UN. Israel claims that lobbying efforts are slowing its momentum. On Tuesday morning, Israeli Navy gunboats surrounded the French ship Dignité while on its way to deliver humanitarian aid and medical supplies to the besieged and impoverished Gaza Strip. The ship reached 50 miles away from the Gaza shore when it was intercepted by the Navy, who demanded all passengers should stand in clear view so that they can be seen by soldiers. The ship was later stopped and boarded by the Israeli armed forces. No clashes were reported. Last year, 9 activists were killed on the Turkish Mavi Marmara boat on a similar mission. The Israeli daily Haaretz reported on Tuesday that American President Barack Obama is demanding that Turkey should end the crisis in its relations with Israel in order to avoid any further deterioration in relations between the two countries. Turkish officials responded by reiterating their demands regarding an official apology from Tel Aviv, as well as compensation to the families of those Turkish victims who were killed or injured when the Israeli Navy attacked the Mavi Marmara last year.
Freedom Flotilla 2 is a fleet of 10 aid ships with peace activists on board seeking to break Israel's siege of occupied Gaza, Palestine. Since the beginning of the month, 8 of the ships have been blockaded in Greek harbors due to anonymous complaints about seaworthiness later traced to Israeli groups. There is also suspicion that Greece agreed with Israel to interfere with the flotilla in return for Israeli and European Union support for their economic bailout and austerity package, a package opposed by most of the Greek public. On July 19th, after all of the obstacles, the French aid ship Dignity was finally approaching the Gaza coast, only to run into the Israeli Navy. While still 40 miles off the coast of Gaza, in international waters, at about 10:40 a.m. local time on the 19th of July, the Israeli Navy surrounded and menaced the French aid ship Dignity. At first, Israeli Navy ships at least one of them looking like a destroyer, surrounded the ship, an unarmed yacht with peace activists on board. Then they told the crew to cut power or be raided by force, like what happened last year when at least 9 peace activists were shot and killed on the Turkish aid ship Mavi Mara. Being an unarmed ship, not even equipped like a Sea Shepherd ship with non-lethal defenses, they were overwhelmed with no means of offering resistance, and at last report were being towed to the Israeli port of Ashdod. Since this occurred in international waters, with no state of war existing between Israel and France, legally this was an act of piracy. We may be a pirate radio station, but this is not the kind of piracy we like. The Greek ship Juliana was also supposed to reach Gaza yesterday, but 2 nations agreed under Israeli pressure to revoke their registration, trapping them in the Greek port of Heraklion, where they had stopped to refuel. Over time, the Juliana may be able to register with another nation, and the Greek Coast Guard at the port of Piraeus may run out of excuses to blockade the rest of the flotilla. At that point, Israel may find 8 or 9 more ships off the coast of Gaza. In the meantime, however, dockside power has been cut off since July 12th. The U.S. aid ship Audacity of Hope besieged at a pier the Greek military shares with the United States. Temperatures on the boat have exceeded 100 degrees, but peace activists are refusing to leave. Code Pink, with 2 U.S. citizens on board the ship, is asking everyone to call the State Department at 202-647-4000 and ask the 24-hour Emergency Operations Center. Tell them that 3 people are still enduring the inhumane, dangerous conditions on the boat. I repeat, that's 202-647-4000. Ask the Emergency Operations Center. Please pull your car over and call 202-647-4000 right now and ask for the Emergency Operations Center at the U.S. State Department. Tell them that this sort of attempt to cook peace activists off their ship at a U.S. shared pier is completely unacceptable.
The Israeli Knesset, or parliament, recently passed a controversial law that criminalizes support for the Palestinian-initiated and led Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, movement. The law, approved on July 11th, states that individuals or organizations advocating a boycott may be sued for compensation by any individual or institution claiming damage as a result. Evidence of actual damage will not be required. The measure also bars the government from doing business with companies that comply with boycotts. The call to resist Israeli occupation by nonviolent means through economic pressure was declared in 2005 and has been gaining momentum around the world. The BDS campaign takes its inspiration from the struggle of South Africans against apartheid, with the goal of persuading the Israeli government to comply with international law and universal principles of human rights. Israeli groups such as the Coalition of Women for Peace and Boycott From Within, which are the targets of the new law, say that the threat of lawsuits will not deter them from promoting BDS inside Israel. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Ofer Nyman, a leader of the group Boycott From Within. He explains that opposition to the bill, now being challenged in court, came from both the left and right, and perhaps will have the opposite effect of what the Israeli government intended.
The law is already going to affect. So far, as far as I know, there have been no lawsuits filed. It feels as if most of the people who support this law are now somewhat on the defensive. I don't know if this means that the law will be repealed.
So opponents of this law say it's an attack on freedom of speech.
And also people saying, and I think they are correct in saying that the law will actually boost the BDS campaign and damage official Israel.
Ofer Nyman, explain how this sentiment against what Israel is doing is expressed within Israel. And the other part of the question is, what connection do you have with Palestinians running the BDS campaign in the West Bank and also international supporters?
I think that more and more Israelis are becoming familiar with the term. One example would be Ehud Barak, the Minister of Defense. He recently gave an interview, and he spoke about BDS, using explicitly this term, as a threat to Israel. Of course, he's one of those stubborn people who will do nothing to change Israeli policies unless he's really pressed hard against the wall. But he did mention BDS as a warning to the Israeli public at large. I think that most Israelis may still be unaware of the explicit term BDS. Again, one of the reasons is that the discourse in Israel has more to do with boycotting the settlement products. That's a different campaign. It's a very partial campaign, somewhat inadequate in my view. So most of the debating is around boycotting settlement products. Our group, which is called, the unofficial name is Boycott From Within. It's an Israeli support group for the Palestinian BDS call from 2005. And we try to spread that message. Of course, there is a strong connection between people in the group and the nonviolent Palestinian campaign against the wall.
So what are the consequences for those Israelis like yourself who continue to call for a boycott of Israel from within? Do you face arrest?
No, we don't face arrest. I mean, we may be arrested if we can't pay the fines eventually, if too many people sue us. But we're not getting arrested because it's only a tort. It's not a criminal offense. Too many people in Israel who are opposing the bill are speaking of Israel as a democracy and saying that democracy may be lost here. And I don't subscribe to this view. I think that I mean, if you look at it, well, Israel is not really a democracy. Israel is closer to being an apartheid state if you consider the occupation. And it's an Israelocentric discourse that if they come for us, even if it's in a very minor way considering what Israel is doing to the Palestinians, then democracy is lost. I mean, democracy has been lost, if there was ever a significant form of democracy here, long ago. So, I mean, people in my group are trying to emphasize that it shouldn't be so much about us as privileged Israelis. It should be more, I mean, the discussion should be more about the Palestinians, about the occupation. And I don't think that Israel will become a totalitarian regime for people like me. One of the main reasons is that Jewish communities abroad are becoming concerned about it. It's bad for their business. It's bad for Israel advocacy if Israel oppresses privileged Jewish citizens. That's why we've seen people like Eric Yoffe and Abe Foxman, prominent figures in the U.S. Jewish establishment, we've seen them speaking out, condemning this boycott law.
Israel's taken extreme steps this summer to keep international supporters of the Palestinian cause out of the region, like pressuring Greece to prevent the Gaza Freedom Flotilla from sailing and pressuring airlines to prevent activists from flying to Tel Aviv and then going on to the West Bank. Do you think Israelis are feeling more isolated or maybe up against the wall than they have for the past several decades?
Well, many Israelis do speak of being feeling somewhat isolated and the world doesn't understand us. But still, I think that now with a campaign which is inherently nonviolent, that many Israelis have to think well beyond that. You know, the average Israeli can speak as much as he or she wants about singling out and global isolation. But it's a very unique campaign, and I think that many Israelis are confused about it. And this confusion is good. We can do something with it, something constructive.
That was Ofer Naiman of the Israeli group Boycott From Within. For more information about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, visit our website at btlonline.org.
Iraq, Sunday. The Pentagon admitted yesterday that another U.S. soldier died Sunday in Iraq in what the Pentagon is calling a non-combat incident. Was this another GI suicide? Afghanistan, Monday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unspecified nationality from non-combat related injuries in an undisclosed location. Again, was this a suicide? Afghanistan, Monday. The British military is reporting the death of a British soldier from an IED blast in the Nahri Sarraj district, Helmand province. Afghanistan, Tuesday. NATO is reporting the death of two soldiers of unspecified nationality from IED attacks in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, yesterday. Seven police officers were first poisoned and then shot dead at a checkpoint in southern Afghanistan. Daoud Ahmadi, a spokesman for Helmand Province, said the policemen were killed by one of their colleagues near Lashkar Gah. Pakistan, yesterday. Mortar shells fired from Afghanistan killed four Pakistani soldiers and wounded two when they hit a paramilitary post on the Pakistani side of the border. Pakistan blamed insurgents. Nobody has taken credit for the attack. Amara, Iraq, Monday and Tuesday. U.S. warplanes attacked areas in southern Iraq city of Amara, the center of Mishan province, on Monday and Tuesday with live weapons, a Mishan province security source reported. The security source said the air raids did not cause any human or material losses, but created a state of terror among the inhabitants of the province after they heard the continuous air raids. Wait a minute! Aren't U.S. combat operations in Iraq supposed to be over? Oh yeah, that's been said before. Mr. Barack Obama, haven't we had enough of 8 and 10 years of useless war? Now's the time to throw in the towel. Bring all the troops and all the planes home today.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Is just a short preview of what's to come if Schweitzer and ExxonMobil and TransCanada have their way, and they have pipelines crisscrossing every part of this state.
Probably heard before that Exxon pipeline disaster. Well, some people are doing something about it. On the 12th of July, at the close of the Earth First Round River Rendezvous in Montana, pro-Earth protesters occupied the office of Montana's governor to protest proposals for oil pipelines to support oil from tar sands mining. They went so far as to dance on the governor's table.
See, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not community on the side.
That's it! We're here today to demand that Governor Schweitzer stop catering to big oil interests, stop catering to companies like ExxonMobil and TransCanada, who are trying to turn our state into an energy extraction colony.
Protesters securing the office locked their arms in the pipes labeled no spill, no mega loads, and no pipelines, and painted black. Each pipe contained an internal pin to which protesters locked their arms. In the YouTube video, the pipes appear to be reinforced Tootsie Rolls, which are made of PVC pipe, chicken wire, tar, and finally duct tape, in this case painted black. They could have been steel, but they sure look like Tootsie Rolls. These are nearly impossible to cut through with any one tool.
I'm from Montana. I grew up 60 miles away in Great Falls, and I cherish Montana. I cherish the beauty here. Governor Schweitzer is catering to big oil, allowing for bigger and bigger pipelines that are jeopardizing that. The Yellowstone River is the longest undammed river in the United States, and there was an oil spill in it. 1,000 barrels went into the river, and they want to bring the Keystone XL pipeline over the same river, which will be even larger and has that much more potential for creating horrible damage.
The governor of Montana got quite an unpleasant surprise being caught in his office by protesters locked in Tootsie Roll devices that made getting him out take 5 hours.
The Silvertip pipeline disaster into the Yellowstone River recently is just a preview of what's to come if you continue to cater to big oil's interests and turn our state into what would essentially be an energy extraction colony.
Oh, yeah, I'm probably not going to do that today. Next question.
Sir, the heritage of this state, like all of this country, was founded in the blood of over 20 million people to conquer North and South America. Our people, white people, killed millions of indigenous. That's the point. That's what's continuing right now at Rubicon Creek in Canada. That's why it's unacceptable. When 21 women try to have children in the community and 19 of them that year have stillbirths, I say, sir, it is time for us to step aside from those corporations, to stand away from those people.
Well, where are you going to stand? You want to know?
Standing here right now.
Sir, sir.
You're talking about people dying and you're making a joke.
This is nothing like.
I'm not making a joke.
It seems pretty clear to us that you're not willing to negotiate. And I'm here to tell you that we're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
With the governor talking trash, or in this case, oil, protesters jumped on his table and danced, just like another group of protesters did at the Jefferson Memorial. They were considerably harder to remove. The lockdown lasted for 6 hours, 5 people were arrested, the governor was forced to speak to the protesters who were right there in his office in a futile effort to get them to unlock and leave. Earth first, oil profits last.
There has been another attack on a pedicab driver by the U.S. Park Police. On Friday, the 15th of July, a U.S. Park Police cop tasered and arrested a pedicab driver, claiming falsely to have been assaulted. The attack was witnessed by another pedicab driver who says the police are lying and he was reaching for his glasses. Here's a report from WAMU Radio interviewing the witness.
The pedicabbers say an officer with the U.S. Park Police confronted a pedicabber named Charles Guillon as he was picking up customers in his bicycle-drawn rickshaw Friday afternoon. Tyler Clark, a law student driving a pedicab this summer, says he saw the whole thing.
It was like an episode of Cops where, you know, the officer screams you're resisting arrest when it appeared like the guy wasn't resisting arrest and the officer was just, you know, being way too forceful for anyone to comply with what he was asking them to do.
Clark says Guillon began to reach for his glasses in his shirt's breast pocket when the officer unholstered his taser, pressed it against Guillon's rib cage, and fired.
The pedicab driver dropped to the ground, was writhing and screaming in pain and agony, and the police officer shot him with the taser one more time.
Pedicabbers on the National Mall say park police are using brutal tactics in a summer crackdown on their fledgling industry. The park police didn't respond to our phone calls and emails, but officials from the agency have previously denied the existence of a crackdown. I'm David Schultz.
The park police may deny the crackdown exists, but their masters at the National Park Service are beating their chest about it, saying they want to protect Tormobile's monopoly. The Washington Examiner quoted Bill Line, a National Park Service spokesman, as saying that it is illegal to pick up passengers because of their exclusive contract with Tormobile. He said, quote, "We cannot allow these pedicabs to pick up and drop off because that would breach the contract with Tormobile." Sorry, Mr. Lane, nobody driving a pedicab ever signed that contract. And a contract with a business partner to use weapons and violence to keep out competition is something the mafia would do. On July 4th, the Washington Post also confirmed that Tormobile is behind this crackdown the park pigs won't even admit exists. Fed up with this outrageous behavior, pedicab drivers responded to Friday's arrest by staging a protest outside the Haynes Point offices of the U.S. Park Police. You can protest too by boycotting the Tormobile Mafia. July 14th, area residents gathered at an apartment building on Irving Street where D.C. police and a heavily armed SWAT team shot and killed an elderly Haitian man named John Louis who had become agitated. He was armed with nothing more than a screwdriver and never threatened any other person. The incident involved only him and a SWAT team. 1 month later, on the 14th of July, outraged neighbors gathered demanding that action be taken to make sure the Metropolitan Police Department never again kills a man because some neighbor reported him to the police as being agitated. Jim Graham showed up. He seems to show up everywhere there's a problem. And he had lots of flowery words about making sure the cops don't kill anybody else. Let's see if his promises translate into action into legislation introduced in the D.C. Council.
Thank you, Terry. And the first report I got of this was talked about all the police that had come out and all of the squad cars. And I heard that before I heard what it was about. And I thought, my God, what is going on in Mount Pleasant? You know, is there some kind of terrorist package? Is there some kind of attack? You know, is there something extraordinary happening? And it took a few minutes, really, before it became apparent that a single man who was facing his own demons and challenges had brought into this neighborhood dozens of heavily armored police officers. And I thought to myself, what is going on? And then, of course, what happened. And I've been thinking about what I wanted to say tonight. I very much appreciate the invitation, I'll say. And I think my conclusion is that this man did not need to die. He shouldn't have died. There ought to have been some way in this civilized city, in this civilized neighborhood, to have done something different where he could have been attended to without killing. And I know that to some of you may seem harsh, and I know that I too want to await the police investigation and all of that, but I think this conclusion for me is inescapable. It's inescapable. So I'm calling on the chief of police to respond immediately to us with an explanation of why this man had to be shot dead in this neighborhood. Because we need to know this. We must know this. And we must know this for our own peace of mind, our own appreciation for each other as fellow human beings. And so we will proceed on this. This is the call to action. I want to be part of the call to action. There's no question about it. We'll get to the bottom of this. So with not only Jean-Louis in mind, but also so this will never happen again, where this amount of police force will be brought to bear on someone who was obviously so challenged. Thank you.
Nice words, Mr. Jim Graham. Now let's see you introduce some legislation before the council to back it up. We've already had one more incident involving MPD. At least this time it wasn't a shooting. WPFW reported that at the Caribbean Festival on Georgia Avenue, the parade was hemmed in by motorcycle cops, horse cops, helicopter cops, and so many sirens people couldn't even hear the bands. What in hell is going on at MPD?
I have heard some people make some very degrading comments about the cops recently, and I personally believe that people should refrain from making degrading comments about the cops, because the cops have a very difficult job, and they do it very well with great pride and integrity. And therefore, I wrote a song in support of the cops, and it goes like this. Come and gather round, you people, now, and listen to me yak. All you doctors and you lawyers and you folks who push the crack, and all you folks who push the buttons and you folks who push the mops. Come listen while I tell you how I really like the cops. Oh, I really like the cops. I think they're pretty cool. I like them in my neighborhood. I like them in my school. I think the cops are wonderful. I think the cops are nice. And I like to have a broken jaw and carry a pack of ice. I really like the cops. I think they're pretty neat. I like it when they take my face and smash it on the street, and then they drag me to a station and they lock me in a room, and then I like it when they rape me up the anus with the broom. I really like the cops, they make me want to sing. You know my favorite movie is that tape of Rodney King, and so I really get pissed off whenever somebody like you suggests we should subject the cops to citizens' review. I really like the cops, I am so glad that they're around to hassle me and ticket me for sitting on the ground. I really love the cops, I'd be so sad if they were gone. There's something about a uniform that always turns me on. Yeah, I really like the cops so much, folks, that I don't think you should find out the number of your local cop watch group. And if there is no cop watch group in your town, that's good. I don't think you should start one. And if you're walking down the street and you see somebody getting hassled by the cops, I don't think you should stop and see what happens. I think you should just walk on by, because that person must deserve everything they get for not looking rich enough for the cops to leave them alone. And if you're with a group of people and the cops start picking on one of you, I don't think you should stick up for that person at all. I think you should just let the police physically and psychologically isolate your companion. And I don't think you should carry one of those little disposable drugstore cameras on your person at all times to document police brutality with when you see it. And I don't think your town should have a civilian review board to investigate citizen complaints against cops. And if you do have a board like that, then I think it should just be a rubber stamp committee that approves of everything the cops do. And if there's a cop in your town who makes a regular habit of beating up unarmed people, or raping women at gunpoint, or raping men at gunpoint, or killing people for an adrenaline rush because he is a psychopath, then I think that he should not be fired. And if he is fired, then that is definitely punishment enough for him, and he should not be prosecuted. And I most definitely do not think that you should put his name and his address and his telephone number and his list of crimes on a flyer and post that flyer all over town. And I don't think you should go to his neighborhood and talk to all his neighbors like people do when a convicted sex offender moves into a neighborhood and let them know what he has done. And I don't think that you should egg his house or slash his tires or run him out of town. And I don't think that when he applies for a job on the police force in the next town over the hill, I don't think you should go to that town too and do the same thing and make sure that he never works as a police officer again. I don't think you should do any of this, because your town has the best police department in the world. Oh yes, I really like the cops. Just to see 'em gets me high. I hope that I get taken into custody and die. And then I hope that every fact that's in the coroner's report gets chucked into a dumpster so it won't be heard in court. A yoodle, a yoodle, a yoodle, a yoodle, a yoodle, a yoodle. I love those boys in blue. And when I hear you making statements that you know are quite obscene, like how the cops are nasty and like how the cops are mean, it makes me want to tell you that you ought to get some class and help your local officers by kicking your own ass. So come gather around you people now and listen to me yak. All you doctors and your lawyers and your folks who push the crack, and all you folks who push the buttons and your folks who push the mops, come listen while I tell you how I really like the cops.
Montgomery County, Maryland, upscale developers in Silver Spring are complaining to the police about young people under 18 hanging out. Due to curfews in D.C. and PG County, and maybe police harassment at Gallery Place, Silver Spring has become one of the few places people under 18 or young-looking without ID documents can hang out without fear of arrest. Apparently the wealthy owners of Silver Spring's fancy new buildings don't like that very much. Everyone wants to make sure they don't have teenagers, it seems. At the request of the police, county executive, and no doubt developers, Montgomery County Council Member Valerie Irvin, who represents Silver Spring, has introduced curfew legislation similar to D.C.'s law, which D.C. cannot effectively enforce. Councilmember Mark Elrich, to his credit, is saying the idea needs further study, a way of blunting the momentum and putting it on the back burner. The complaints from business owners center on teens in general, yet they say this law is needed to prevent gangs from coming to Silver Spring in the future. This, in turn, means the real target of the law is young people of color, especially Montgomery County's Latino community. Out of fear of gangs that are not even going to Silver Spring, the police and developers want to see young people, and especially young people of color, swept off the streets by armed police in all of Montgomery County, even places 20 miles from Silver Spring. They've gone so far as to propose that Rockville and Gaithersburg, where the proposed county law could not apply, would have to pass curfews too, for fear of becoming curfew-free zones. What have we come to when rich suit and tie developers have the power to order police with guns to arrest or detain people simply for being under 18 and out at night? Don't they understand that just one negative encounter with the police is enough to turn many young people into permanent enemies of all law enforcement and all of the people who stand behind it? Don't they understand that the real gangs, including MS-13 and even a few jihadi groups, recruit in the very prisons they send people to? In Iraq and Afghanistan, when people are treated as insurgents, many of them decide to become insurgents. That was how the resistance in occupied Iraq grew. It began with a few former members of the government attacking U.S. troops, especially after an incident involving a U.S. helicopter, a flag on a mosque, and police aggression against the crowd. Soon the attacks mushroomed, and the U.S. responded with a policing model of raiding people's homes. Many of those raided decided to become insurgents themselves, and within months the war mushroomed. Less than a year later, those four Blackwater thugs were sprung from that famous bridge in Fallujah, and it was on!
Godzilla! Rupert Murdoch's international media empire, News Corp, is being shaken to its very foundations as a result of an ever-expanding scandal surrounding the conduct of reporters working for his British tabloid newspaper, News of the World. Reporters and editors at the paper have been involved in hacking into the phones of politicians, celebrities, the royal family, and crime victims, including 13-year-old schoolgirl Millie Dowler, who had been abducted and murdered. Murdoch employees are also charged with bribing police officials to get leads on news stories. As pressure on Murdoch and his son James ratcheted up, News of the World was closed, and many top officials of the company have resigned. British police have arrested News Corp CEO Rebecca Brooks, along with 9 other Murdoch employees. One of those under arrest is Andy Coulson, former News of the World editor and communications director to Conservative Party British Prime Minister David Cameron. 2 top Scotland Yard officials with ties to Murdoch have also resigned. U.S. media properties owned by Rupert Murdoch, a naturalized American citizen, include 27 television stations, 20th Century Fox, The Wall Street Journal, HarperCollins, The New York Post, and Fox News. With allegations that Murdoch reporters had attempted to hack the phones of 9/11 victims, some U.S. legislators have called for an FBI and Justice Department investigation. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Steve Rendell, senior analyst with the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. He assesses the political influence Murdoch has wielded in the U.S. and the prospect that the scandal could cause News Corp to lose its broadcast licenses under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
Well, I think when you look at the scandal and you look at the sort of the very clearly illegal things that are being alleged, like phone hacking, I think it's fair for American news consumers, American citizens, to ask, one, if there should be an investigation into News Corp, into Murdoch's holdings here. That's just for the things that are clearly illegal. But since we own the airwaves, which do not include cable, by the way, but we do own the broadcast airwaves, and Fox owns many, many broadcast licenses, we have a right to ask if somebody of Murdoch's character, we already knew some pretty negative things about his character before any of these things happened. But if some of these other allegations are true, we're allowed to have a debate over here about whether he should play the large role that he plays in our national media. And I think there's a larger story, too, and this is what John Nichols from The Nation, and he's been a regular commentator on the BBC recently, and I was talking to him last week, and he was pointing out that Murdoch played a significant role in getting George Bush into office, in getting Tony Blair into office in the UK, and getting John Howard into office in Australia, 3 of the chief point men in bringing us to war in Iraq. So these are some of the major questions, I think, that need to be addressed. We certainly have a right to ask for investigations, and we have a right to ask, depending on what those investigations find, we have a right to ask how large a role Murdoch and his organization should be able to play in our national debate.
As you laid out, Rupert Murdoch wields enormous influence in both Britain, Australia, and the United States with his news holdings in terms of influencing the political debate. We're all in favor of free speech, but does Rupert Murdoch and his media properties somehow violate the law or some kind of unwritten ethical code in terms of how he wields that influence, what he does with that influence?
Well, I think that as far as we know in the United States, we haven't got him breaking the law. We have him degrading journalism. We have him basically turning news organizations into propaganda outfits where lying and name-calling is a feature, not a bug. It's not something that happens. It's not an aberration. It's part of the organization. It's absolutely organic. Lying and name-calling are absolutely organic to most of Murdoch's holdings here. We do know that from some local Fox News stations, Fox Radio now has a lot of very vitriolic hosts on, and certainly Fox News Channel and the New York Post are name-calling organizations and really degrade journalism here.
With this scandal and the embarrassment and I think a lot of revulsion that people have about the kinds of activities that the Murdoch papers and media outlets were engaged in, could not this scandal be a catalyst to reimpose some regulations that would favor media diversity in this country and re-regulate so that we have more diverse views in our media system and we wouldn't have a situation where a media mogul like Murdoch wielded undue influence among politicians, whether it be here in the United States or in places like Australia and Britain?
Let me make this side issue, too. If you're a criminal organization, you cannot have a broadcast license in the United States. So if the Murdoch organization, News Corp or News International is the branch that's in the UK, if it is found culpable of crimes or if its major executives are found guilty of crimes, there could be a pretty good argument made to take away its broadcast licenses here. I have no faith that that will happen. Of course, General Electric has committed crimes. It's been convicted. And if people do start talking about maybe stripping Murdoch of certain FCC or certain media holdings here, the other media will quickly circle the wagons and say, yeah, it's just Murdoch. That's the problem. And so I don't think you'd see any across-the-board regulation because I think a lot of them would be pointing their fingers at Murdoch and at News Corp and saying, but they're the problem, so don't. Why are you coming after us? I think if media activists, media democracy activists, want to see something like real re-regulation of our media and a much fairer arrangement where a lot more people, in line with Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, where a lot more people would have access to media, you'd have a lot more minority ownership of licenses and the like. If they want to see that, they're going to have to do a lot more work at getting a progressive administration and progressive legislators in. Because basically what we've seen over 30 years is we've seen Republicans or Democrats, people that were for deregulation, and certainly the Obama administration and the head of the FCC, Janikowski, have not shown that they are going to be protective of the people's voice in our national media. They seem to be more or less enablers of even greater consolidation and less regulation.
That was Steve Rendell, senior analyst with the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. Read more about FAIR and the Murdoch scandal on our website at btlonline.org.
Chocolate City, this is movement music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming.
Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Something.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave labors. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market, hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize, soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than the male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you
or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about chocolate city unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart.
It's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holla black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, Sinister, Strom Thurmond, similar Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee your plantation mentality. Results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they wanna come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmarts in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
With dire warnings from economists about an imploding economy and threats by ratings agencies Moody's and Standard & Poor's to downgrade Washington's sterling credit rating, the White House and Congress have not yet negotiated a deal to raise the federal government's $14.3 trillion debt ceiling. With less than 2 weeks left before the August 2nd deadline, President Obama expressed hope that an agreement would be reached to raise the debt ceiling in time. While earlier negotiations to reach a so-called grand bargain to cut $4 trillion from the nation's debt failed, the president lauded the Senate's bipartisan Gang of Six for coming up with a new 11th-hour framework to cut $3.7 trillion from the federal budget over 10 years. The plan reportedly includes a reduction in tax rates through tax code reform and an immediate $500 billion in budget cuts, coming in part by imposing changes to the Social Security system's cost of living adjustment formula, known as chained CPI. Progressive activists have been greatly concerned by President Obama's willingness to offer major cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid during the current debt ceiling negotiations. The Progressive Change Campaign Committee recently delivered 200,000 petition signatures to Obama's Chicago campaign headquarters, pledging not to volunteer or donate to the president's campaign if he cuts Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security benefits. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Eric Kingson, co-director of the Strengthened Social Security Campaign, a coalition of 300 national and state organizations. He explains why he opposes the so-called $4 trillion grand bargain and the damage he believes will be caused by slashing the nation's social safety net programs.
First of all, there is no grand bargain if everybody's Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid is being cut dramatically, which is what's been proposed in part here. Backing up, we have a deficit. It's a long-run deficit one day we have to get to. It is not the most important problem we face. There are many other problems we face. There are 14 million Americans who aren't working. There are 2 wars that haven't been paid for that are still going. There are huge tax cuts that have brought us to this point, along with the deregulation that helped bring us this economy. And there was also the passage of the Medicare Part D pharmaceutical benefits, which wasn't funded either during the Bush years. So What we have is basically a revenue problem. We have not been responsible in paying for the kinds of policies that particularly took place in the early part of the first decade of the millennium. What we're dealing with is a coordinated effort by some to delegitimize Social Security and Medicare and to define these as core issues with the federal debt. Social Security never has and never will borrow a penny because by law it cannot have borrowing authority. It doesn't borrow. If Social Security did not have enough resources coming into it, then benefits by law would be reduced. So Social Security has absolutely no place in the deficit discussion. It's important to understand that Social Security is adequately financed for 25 years. Under the best estimates, the Congressional Budget Office, the Social Security actuaries, various people who make it, say it can pay all benefits out 25 years, and then after that, after about 2035, it's about 23 cents short on the dollar. And that can be addressed in a variety of ways. You could scrap the cap asking Americans to pay 6.2% on all their earnings. You could, for instance, to get a sense of the dimension of this problem, the projected shortfall in Social Security is the equivalent to roughly what it would cost to continue the Bush tax cuts for the richest 2% of Americans. This is not a difficult problem to address. It's a matter of political choice.
Eric Kingston, President Obama has put squarely on the table Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid as a bargaining chip. Obama says he'll cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid if the Republicans remove tax subsidies for private jet owners and big oil companies. What exactly do you feel is his motivation in terms of putting on the chopping block these very popular programs that are really a lifeline to some of the poorest, sickest, and most elderly people in the country who've put a lot of money into these programs in exchange for some minor concessions on the part of Republicans?
I don't know what his motivation is. I'm not going to try to guess that. What I do know is what the effect of doing this is. The cost of living adjustment and Social Security has been put on the table. The president had promised he would not cut benefits for current beneficiaries, but the current proposal that we hear has been on the table is to change the cost of living adjustment so that over time, everybody receives a smaller benefit. Someone who's 65 today, when they're 85, would get a cost of living adjustment that would be worth $1,000 less that year. So there's a decision made to pull some dollars out of pockets of hardworking people, people who've earned their benefits. And that contradicts the promises the president has made. It contradicts the promises of Democrats and Republicans, many Republicans, if we move forward with that. Also on the table, as part of the effort to show how balanced they are, we hear the idea of raising the Medicare retirement age to 67. Absolutely absurd. We should be talking about lowering the age of Medicare to cover older workers who are unable to maintain their employment in a very difficult economy, many of whom leave work because of health problems. We were going in the right direction with the Affordable Care Act, not perfect, but moving forward. This contradicts the act. It's horrible that this has been put forward as a negotiable item. I guess the motivation, I believe, is to show how reasonable we are, but frankly, with hostage takers, I don't think we should be exercising reason. It would be my hope that the president would go to the American public and say, look, here's what's at stake.
Eric, tell us what your group, Strengthen Social Security Campaign, a coalition of groups all over the country, what are they doing to ensure or to do their best to prevent the White House and Congress from axing Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid?
What we're doing right now is we're focusing very heavily on the cost of living adjustment proposals that have been put on the table. We're also trying to send a message and encourage our friends in the White House to pivot and move away from putting Social Security on the chopping block, and particularly sending messages to all members, particularly the Republicans, that if they push cuts in Social Security, their constituents aren't going to be happy, not even the Republican constituents. When we deal with Social Security, don't deal with it behind closed doors. It has to be dealt with in the open because it's such a trust for the American people, and it always has been. Let's not have a sneak attack on Social Security.
That was Eric Kingston, co-director of the Strengthen Social Security campaign. Learn more about the Coalition's work to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.